Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of American Criminal. In our latest season, the child of Italian immigrants sets out to achieve the American dream. And if he has to spill some blood along the way, so be it. Listen to American Criminal, Al Capone, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get ad-free access to the entire season first, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
It's just before 9 p.m. on September 12, 1826, at a local jail in Canandaigua, New York. The jailer is away on business, so his wife, Mrs. Mary W. Hall, is left to fend for herself and watch over the prisoners. It's a quiet night, until the door opens.
How do you do, ma'am?
Mrs. Hall responds with a polite curtsy.
How do you do?
Mrs. Hall, my name is Mr. Lawton Lawson. Is your husband away, ma'am?
Yes, sir. He'll be back shortly, though.
Well, I'm afraid I'm in a bit of a hurry. If it's all right, I'd like to speak with one of your prisoners, Captain William Morgan.
Morgan was brought to the jail just yesterday on charges of thievery, charges he's adamantly denied ever since he set foot in his cell.
Would it be all right if I spoke with Mr. Morgan in private?
Mrs. Hall hesitates. Mr. Lawson looks harmless enough. He's well-dressed, well-spoken. But there's something about him, though, something peculiar. She can't quite put her finger on it.
I'll only be a moment, ma'am, I assure you.
Reluctantly, she agrees, and leads Mr. Lawson to the cell where Captain Morgan sits on a bench, his wrists bound. Lawson peers at him through the bars of the jail cell and turns to Mrs. Hall.
I'd like to speak with him alone, please.
Of course.
Mrs. Hall starts to retreat to the front room, but something in her gut stops her short. She keeps her distance, but leans in to hear the hushed conversation.
What say you, Mr. Morgan?
I'm innocent.
I understand. If you will allow me, I will pay your debt and I will take you out of here.
When?
Tonight. Will you go with me, sir?
Yes, yes.
Good. I just need a few moments to discuss it with the jailer's wife.
Hearing her name, Mrs. Hall quickly busies herself in the front room, arranging papers and uncluttering her husband's desk. Mr. Lawson enters.
I'd like to pay for this man's release.
Sir?
Whatever the cost of the claim, whatever the cost to your husband, I will meet the price.
Well, you'll have to speak with him.
Surely we can come to an agreement, Mrs. Hall.
Lawson pulls out his wallet and flashes her a large stack of cash.
As I said, my husband will be back shortly.
I suppose I'll wait then.
But Lawson didn't wait. He left and came back with even more money and two more men. The three of them pressured Mrs. Hall and coerced her into letting Morgan go. On the evening of September 12th, she unlocked the prison door. Lawson quickly led Morgan outside where a carriage was waiting. But before Mrs. Hall could even close the jail door, she heard cries in the streets. She looked outside and saw Captain Morgan struggling with the three men. They forced him into the carriage and drove him to nearby Fort Niagara. There, he mysteriously disappeared. Morgan would never be seen or heard from again. It is believed Morgan was abducted and murdered by an influential fraternal society called the Freemasons. Morgan was a Freemason himself, but shortly before his dubious arrest, Morgan had announced his intentions to publish a tell-all book exposing the secrets of Freemasonry. Morgan's disappearance was more than just a mystery, though. It gave rise to a political movement, arguably the first third party in American political history, the Anti-Masons.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Wicked Game is sponsored by Factor. It's been a busy month for me. We launched a new podcast with another one coming soon, all while keeping six others that we work on going strong. So I'll be frank, it's been stressful and time-consuming. What could be a perfect storm of conditions to ruin my healthy eating habits? It's so easy to go grab drive-thru, right? But I didn't, because there's Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal kit. Chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door with over 35 different options every week to choose from, including keto, calorie smart, vegan, veggie, all the ways you want to eat healthy. And there's even more to enjoy with over 55 nutrition-packed add-ons that'll help make your weekly meal planning even more delicious. And I'm dead serious when I tell you they hit the spot. Not only are they tasty, but satisfying, something you don't often get in nutritious food. Plus, it's all ready in just 2 minutes. No prep, no mess. Perfect for your most busy, stressful times and all the rest, too. Head to factormeals.com/wickedgame50 and use code WICKEDGAME50 to get 50% off. That's code WICKEDGAME50 at factormeals.com/WICKEDGAME50 to get 50% off. From Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Elections Wicked Game. In the election of 1836, there were two major political parties, the well-established pro-Jackson Democrats and the newly formed Whigs. The Whigs were not yet a fully formed party with national dimension. They were born out of the ashes of the National Republican faction, a successor of sorts to the Federalist Party of John Adams and Alexander Hamilton. They were a hodgepodge of conflicting political ideas. Still, the Whigs agreed on one point. As president, Andrew Jackson had gone too far in expanding the powers of the presidency. During his tenure in the White House, President Andrew Jackson went to war with the Second Bank of the United States, blocking its recharter. Jackson's bank war gave rise to strong resistance, especially in the North, and it became a rallying cry for the Whig Party. The Whigs coalesced around a unifying principle: Congress, not the president, should control the reins of power. But in the 1830s, there was another anti-Jackson movement on the rise, the anti-Masons, arguably the first third party in U.S. history. Initially, the anti-Masons formed around a single issue, destroying the Freemasons, a secret society they deemed dangerous to democracy. In 1836, three men who had served as U.S. presidents were known to be members: George Washington, James Monroe, and the current president, Andrew Jackson. In the run-up to the 1836 contest, the Whigs and the anti-Masons would find common cause in their opposition to the man they called King Andrew I. But Jackson would not be on the ballot in 1836. He would uphold tradition and step aside at the end of his second term. But his legacy would be at issue. In the 1836 contest, Jackson's chosen successor, Martin Van Buren, would go to war with the anti-Mason Whig coalition. To defeat them, he would seek to bridge a growing divide in the Democratic Party over a controversial issue that threatened to wound his campaign: slavery. This is episode 13, 1836, Sin on the Ballot. It's January 1831 at the Washington residence of Secretary of State Martin Van Buren. Dozens of ladies and gentlemen are gathered for a social occasion, Van Buren's weekly dinner party. As always, it's a who's who of Washington. Among the guests are a slew of power players in Congress, including Felix Grundy, a pro-Jackson senator from Tennessee, and his wife. As Van Buren hobnobs with the crowd, Grundy pulls him aside. "Mr. Van Buren, shame about the weather." "Yes, Senator, the snow has been unbearable. I prefer to hold these weekly dinners Saturday evenings, but sadly, the weather left me no choice but to reschedule. Still, a delightful turnout." "Yes, everyone seems to be enjoying themselves." "Well, not everyone." Grundy gestures across the room to a long-faced guest, Jackson's vice president, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina.
"Oh, excuse me, Mr. Grundy. I wasn't expecting the vice president. I must shake his hand and invite him to sit with me. Anyone who is anyone in Washington will be here tonight, so it's important, in the interest of party unity, that we be seen as friends. Well, don't let him spoil your fun."
Van Buren crosses the room and greets Calhoun with a smile and a friendly embrace.
"Mr. Vice President, I'm certainly glad you're here."
But Calhoun is curt in his response.
"Thank you for the invitation."
Van Buren immediately clocks Calhoun's cold demeanor.
and he knows precisely why Calhoun is standoffish. President Jackson and his vice president are at odds over a myriad of issues, and rumors abound that Jackson will replace Calhoun as vice president in the upcoming election of 1832. There are even rumors he plans to replace Calhoun with Martin Van Buren. As Calhoun scowls, Van Buren lays on the charm. "I'll admit, Mr. Vice President, I'm surprised to find you here. I despaired when you did not respond to my invitation. My health has been poorly." Again, Calhoun is curt and cold. Van Buren can see the conversation is going nowhere. Still, he extends an olive branch. "Will you sit with me and Senator Grundy at dinner, Mr. Calhoun?" Calhoun doesn't answer. "If you would do me the honor of escorting Senator Grundy's wife to the ballroom and saving seats for all of us, I would be much obliged." After a moment of hesitation, Calhoun replies, "It would be my pleasure." As Calhoun goes in search of Mrs. Grundy, her husband saddles up next to Van Buren. "Did he spoil your fun?"
"No.
I asked him to dine with us and to escort your wife to dinner." "And how did he reply?" "He agreed. The vice president is going to behave himself, or so it seems." Van Buren and Senator Grundy watch as Calhoun takes Mrs. Grundy by the arm and escorts her into the dining room. He saves seats for all of them. But then, in a deliberate snub, he places Mrs. Grundy directly between himself and Martin Van Buren. Van Buren notices the slight. So does Senator Grundy, who tries to ease the tension.
"Please, Vice President Calhoun, don't let my wife come between you and Mr. Van Buren."
Without missing a beat, Calhoun cuts his eyes at Van Buren and responds,
"Believe me, Senator, there's nothing that will bring us together."
Calhoun's message at Van Buren's dinner party in January of 1831 was clear. Calhoun was no longer a friend to Andrew Jackson or his Secretary of State. The rift between them only widened when Jackson did drop Calhoun and made Van Buren his running mate in the 1832 contest. In the years after the 32 election, the rift grew wider still. Throughout his presidency, Jackson pushed for controversial tariffs meant to bolster American industry. In response, though, John C. Calhoun and his home state of South Carolina declared Jackson's tariffs unconstitutional and refused to enforce them. Pro-Jackson Democrats in Congress answered South Carolina with the Force Bill, a law giving Jackson authority to use military force against South Carolina or other states to compel their cooperation. Ultimately, a compromise was struck and disaster was avoided, but the nullification crisis, as it would come to be called, poured fuel on the fire of anti-Jackson sentiment, especially in the South. Sensing growing discontent in the 1836 contest, John C. Calhoun would try to wrest control of the Democratic Party from the grip of Andrew Jackson and his heir apparent, Martin Van Buren. To steal his party's nomination, Calhoun would weaponize one of the most controversial political issues of 1830s America, slavery. Slavery had been a divisive issue from the very beginning of American democracy, but it had largely been tabled in the name of compromise. During the Constitutional Convention, the framers agreed to protect slavery in order to secure the South's support for the Constitution. The Three-Fifths Compromise, which allowed slave states to count three-fifths of their slave population toward congressional representation, had helped achieve representational balance between North and South, but it was a painful and difficult process. Founding Father John Dickinson had said, "Acting before the world, what will be said of this new principle of founding a right to govern freemen on a power derived from slaves, the omitting of the word would be regarded as an endeavor to conceal a principle of which we are ashamed." That silent shame hung over the nation from its inception, until the spring of 1820, when the founder's sin made its way into the heart of American politics. After months of heated debate over slavery's expansion in the West, Congress had passed the Missouri Compromise, a law prohibiting slavery in new territories north of the 36 degree 32nd parallel. The Missouri Compromise had satisfied, though, almost no one. For pro-slavery advocates, the compromise had gone too far. For anti-slavery Americans, it had not gone far enough. But once again, compromise had forestalled an inevitable clash between the regions that would ultimately result in civil war. The other political debates of the 1830s over issues like tariffs, internal improvements, and the Second Bank of the United States were on their surface debates over the government's proper role in economic development. But to the South, these issues were part and parcel of the question of slavery. As one Virginian congressman explained, If Congress could interfere in the economic activity of the individual states, they may emancipate every slave in the country. In the election of 1828, almost every slave state had voted for Andrew Jackson, in large part thanks to the efforts of Martin Van Buren to unite the North and South behind Jackson's candidacy. In 1832, Jackson had performed nearly as well. But Van Buren knew that without Southern support, his election in 1836 would be impossible. And so, in the upcoming contest, to garner Southern support, Van Buren would have to defend his record on slavery. He would have to prove himself a friend to the peculiar institution and a worthy candidate to the people of the South. In the summer of 1834, Van Buren wrote to Samuel Gwinn, a prominent figure in Mississippi politics. "Dear sir, I owe you an apology for not having sooner acknowledged the receipt of your obliging letter of 26th May. My opinions on the subject of the power of Congress over slave property in the southern states are so well understood by my friends that I am surprised that an attempt to impose upon the public respecting them should be hazarded." But Van Buren's record on slavery, even if well known to his friends in Washington, was problematic to the South. He was also a northerner from New York, which made him potentially untrustworthy. In his letter to Gwinn, Van Buren sought to put Southern concerns to rest. He wrote that slavery is, in my judgment, exclusively under the control of the state governments. Van Buren's letter, by design, was published in Virginia's Richmond Inquirer and widely circulated all across the South. But while Van Buren sought to defend his record on slavery, John C. Calhoun sought to use that same record to his advantage. In the summer of 1834, Calhoun wrote to a colleague, "As it regards the next presidential election, I think it may be assumed that the States' Rights Party of the South will rally on no man that does not openly avow and support their doctrines. The South will soon be unanimous, and experience has shown that when united, they cannot be defeated." Calhoun didn't overtly state it in the letter, but he had every intention of being the candidate to unite them. So Calhoun used the anti-Jackson newspaper, Washington's United States Telegraph, as a weapon against Van Buren. He sought to portray Van Buren as a friend of the nascent anti-slavery movement, a weak man, devoid of principle, who had caved to the demands of anti-slavery fanatics. But while Van Buren and Calhoun fought it out over the South, another Southern candidate made his presence known in the presidential field. Senator Hugh Lawson White of Tennessee, the first de facto Whig to enter the contest. The story of White's candidacy began in the midst of a power struggle in the House of Representatives, a political battle that threatened to deprive Van Buren of the White House and to deny Jackson his legacy. In June of 1834, a Tennessee congressman named John Bell was elected Speaker of the House. Bell had been a longtime supporter of Andrew Jackson, but after Jackson's election, rumors began to circulate that Bell had turned traitor, that he had abandoned Jackson and hitched his wagon instead to Jackson's longtime adversary, Nicholas Biddle, the president of the Second Bank of the United States. Jackson had not supported Bell's bid for the speakership. Instead, Jackson had thrown his weight behind one of his protégés in Congress, future President James K. Polk. And once the rumors about Bell's disloyalty began to circulate, Polk and the pro-Jackson members of Congress went on the attack, lambasting Bell for his coziness with Biddle's bank. In response, Bell's supporters struck back at Jackson's successor, Martin Van Buren. And in defending Bell, their man from Tennessee, in December of 1834, the Tennessee legislature convened and backed the Tennessee Senator Hugh Lawson White as a candidate for president. Like Bell, White had been a pro-Jackson man. But like so many others, Jackson's disregard for congressional authority had turned White against him. So when the Tennessee delegation approached White and asked him to stand in the election, he was happy to oblige. And in early January 1835, the Alabama legislature followed Tennessee's lead and also formally backed White for president. That same month, two pro-White newspapers sprung up in Washington and started amplifying White's candidacy and launching attacks at Martin Van Buren. For Jackson, White's candidacy was a personal affront. Tennessee was his home state. Jackson wrote to a colleague in Philadelphia, "It would have been regarded as slanderous 6 months ago if anyone had said that a leading politician in Tennessee would have been looked to as a means of preventing union in our ranks." Jackson implored Polk and his friends in Congress to preserve Tennessee from the disgrace of uniting with a piebald opposition to put down my administration and my fame with it. But there was little Jackson and his friends in Congress could do. White would ultimately win Tennessee's nomination. Whig opposition to Martin Van Buren's candidacy did not just stop with Senator White. In the election of 1836, two more major Whig candidates would emerge, each from a different region and each running on a decidedly anti-Jackson platform. And as these opposition candidates sprung up all across the country, Andrew Jackson grew increasingly paranoid that his Whig opponents were out to destroy more than just his legacy. As the election of 1836 drew near, Jackson was convinced that his enemies and the newly formed Whig Party were out for blood.
Wicked Game is sponsored by NetSuite. Here's some quick and easy math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more profit you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more these days. So to reduce costs and the headaches associated with them, switch to NetSuite, the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. And with NetSuite, you'll also reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud, no hardware required, and accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because now you've got one unified business management suite. And you improve efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math for yourself. See how you'll profit with NetSuite this year. Now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/elections. That's netsuite.com/elections. netsuite.com/elections. If you're a careful Wicked Game listener, you know in the credits, I mentioned my friend Professor Greg Jackson and his podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. It's a great show. But one way it can doesn't suck even more is when you listen to it without ads. You can listen to all episodes of American Election's Wicked Game, all episodes of History That Doesn't Suck, and all episodes of many more great history podcasts without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com. History That Doesn't Suck is a deeply researched chronological survey of American history from a trained academic who also knows how to tell a story. Plus, in addition to ad-free listening to one of the best American history podcasts out there, you get scores of bonus episodes at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com.
It's January 30th, 1835, in the House chamber in Washington. The funeral of South Carolina Congressman Warren R. Davis has just concluded. President Jackson stands in the midst of a crowd of statesmen, luminaries, and mourners. Old Hickory is 67 years old, a shadow of the man he once was. He's gray and feeble, his health failing him. His hand shakes as he grips his cane and struggles to stay upright. His Treasury Secretary, Levi Woodbury, offers a helping hand.
Are you all right, Mr. President?
I'm fine.
As Jackson brushes him off, Woodbury discreetly places his hand on Jackson's elbow to prop him up. Navy Secretary Malone Dickerson makes his way through the crowd.
The President's carriage is ready.
Woodbury gently takes the President by the arm and gestures to the exit.
Right this way, Mr. President.
As Woodbury and Dickerson lead Jackson out of the chamber, they do their best to keep him upright and moving. The three men emerge from the rotunda onto the front porch and head down the steps in front of the east portico. As they make their way through the crowd, a well-dressed man steps in front of them, blocking their path. Woodbury addresses him.
Pardon me, sir. May we pass?
The well-dressed man does not stand aside. Instead, without a word and suddenly, he raises a pistol from his side and trains it on President Jackson. The cap explodes, but the bullet doesn't fire. Something in Jackson snaps. Despite his poor health and advancing age, he leaps into action. He turns his cane into a bludgeon and advances on his assailant. But the assassin stands firm. He drops the pistol and pulls a second from his coat. He pulls back the hammer. And again, the cap explodes, but the gun misfires. Jackson's advance picks up speed. The assassin drops the second pistol and shrinks away, terrified. Before Jackson reaches him, a Navy officer in the crowd tackles the would-be assassin to the ground. Woodbury and Dickerson attempt to hold Jackson back, and angrily, Jackson roars, "Let me alone, let me alone. I know where this came from." As men in the crowd restrain his assailant, the enraged Jackson is forced into his carriage, and as it drives away from the scene, a single thought burns in Jackson's mind. He knows exactly who's behind this attack. His enemies in the opposition party, the Whigs. In January 1835, Andrew Jackson survived the first assassination attempt of a president in American history. Jackson was convinced his enemies in the Whig Party were behind the attack, but the facts did not support his suspicions. His would-be assassin, Richard Lawrence, suffered from insanity. In his trial, he claimed he was the real King of England, and he dressed the part in a gray shooting jacket, a black cravat, a vest, and brown pantaloons. He told the jury, "It is for me, gentlemen, to pass judgment upon you, and not you upon me." At trial, Lawrence was found not guilty and confined to an insane asylum in Washington. The Whigs were not behind the attack, but Jackson was right about one thing. The Whigs were determined to damage his legacy by blocking Martin Van Buren's path to the White House. Hugh Lawson White had risen against him in the South. And now in January 1835, a second Whig candidate emerged in New England, Massachusetts Senator Daniel Webster. Webster had been a reliable advocate for New England's interests for years. He had been a member of the Federalist Party and the National Republican faction. He had risen to prominence after the infamous Haynes-Webster debate of 1830, where Webster had taken the South to task on a myriad of issues, but most importantly, slavery. In late January 1835, the Massachusetts legislature nominated Daniel Webster unanimously. His presidential campaign had already been up and running for months. He had raised a large sum of money and assumed control of a Boston newspaper, the Atlas, which was used to amplify his candidacy. With Webster's campaign in full tilt in the North and White in the South, Martin Van Buren sought to wrap up his nomination at the Democratic National Convention. And in the spring of 1835, Martin Van Buren caught a lucky break. His main rival for the Democratic nomination, John C. Calhoun, withdrew from the race. Calhoun had banked his presidential aspirations on the existence of a growing pro-states rights, anti-Van Buren sentiment in the South. But the spring elections in Virginia proved Calhoun had miscalculated. Virginia's electorate restored the pro-Jackson Democratic majority in Congress. And additionally, the rise of Hugh Lawson White in Tennessee had dampened Calhoun's prospects as the Southern candidate. Calhoun was therefore forced to accept the inevitable and step aside. Later, in May of 1835, the Democratic Party held a national nominating convention in Baltimore. Hundreds of delegates attended from nearly every state. They upheld the rules they had established at the nominating convention of 1832. Each state had to vote as a bloc, and a candidate needed two-thirds of the state's votes to secure the nomination. With Calhoun out of the race, Van Buren easily won the required two-thirds, which made the real contest at the convention the one for vice presidency. Van Buren's choice was Richard M. Johnson, a war hero from the western state of Kentucky. Johnson gave geographical balance to the Van Buren ticket, and like Jackson before him, as a war hero, Johnson had popular appeal. Johnson's supporters claimed that he had killed the legendary Indian warrior Tecumseh during the War of 1812. His campaign slogan was Rumpsy Dumpsy, Colonel Johnson killed Tecumseh. But almost immediately after Johnson's vice presidential nomination, scandal erupted. In June of 1835, the United States Telegraph wrote an article detailing the manner in which Johnson had won the vice presidential nomination. Tennessee had not sent any delegates to the convention. When it was discovered that Johnson could not win without Tennessee's votes, the Telegraph alleged, "They picked up some man in the streets and put him up to give the vote of Tennessee for Johnson." Because of the convention unit rule, this man off the streets cast 15 votes for the entire state of Tennessee and swung the nomination to Johnson. Van Buren, the article claimed, intended to put a slight upon Tennessee. But Johnson's dubious victory at the convention was just the tip of the iceberg. Richard M. Johnson also had a secret. He had fathered two daughters with a mulatto woman named Julia Chin, a slave he had inherited from his father. Julia had died in the cholera epidemic in 1833. but the rumors about Julia persisted long after her death. And so in June of 1835, the Telegraph published a scandalous exposé of what they called the disgraceful nomination of Richard M. Johnson to the vice presidency. The article stated, "It may be a matter of no importance to the mere political automatons whether Richard M. Johnson has been in connection with a jet-black, thick-lipped, odoriferous Negro wench, by whom he has reared a family of children, whom he has endeavored to force upon society as every way worthy of being considered the equals and the associates of his free white fellow citizens. It matters not, we say, with Mr. Van Buren and his fellers, what may be the color of either Johnson, his wife, or his children. But thank God, to the great majority of the people of the United States, we may with safety address ourselves on this subject, with a full conviction that in their breast we shall find a response to the patriotic feelings which induce the appeal." In response to the Telegraph, the pro-Jackson paper, The Globe, published a letter written by a man named Thomas Henderson. Henderson, Johnson's longtime neighbor in Kentucky, categorically denied the Telegraph's assertion. The Globe went on to say that Henderson's statement can be vouched for by the whole neighborhood in which Colonel Johnson lives. The Democratic Convention never officially responded to the charges against Johnson. Instead, in July of 1835, they released a sort of unofficial national platform praising Andrew Jackson's policies and hailing Van Buren and Johnson as the men who would carry them forward. For the Democrats, no comment was the best comment. Still, the scandal over Johnson's private life would not blow over. It would plague Van Buren's campaign, and it would threaten to deprive him of the White House. In July of 1835, while the Democrats pushed their platform, Daniel Webster was hard at work in Pennsylvania. Webster knew that to win Pennsylvania, he would need the support of a rising third party who held the reins of power in the Keystone State, the Anti-Masons. Webster sent a formal letter to Anti-Mason leaders in Pennsylvania, pledging his support to their cornerstone principle. Webster wrote, "Secret societies should be prohibited by law." His Anti-Mason friends in the states replied to Webster that his victory in Pennsylvania was all but assured. This was critical because Pennsylvania had particular importance in the 1836 contest, especially for the Whigs. As Henry Clay, a Whig leader in the Senate, wrote in July, "The Keystone State holds the election of 1836 in her hands." Many Whigs had hoped Clay himself, a Whig of national prominence, would make a run for the White House, but he never did, and for good reason. Clay was a Freemason. He knew this fact made him a non-starter for the powerful Anti-Masons. But Henry Clay saw the viability of a different candidate, the third to enter the fold, General William Henry Harrison of Ohio, another hero of the War of 1812. In Clay's mind, Harrison was a winning candidate. Van Buren's running mate, Richard Johnson, could claim he had killed Tecumseh, but Harrison could boast of a similar achievement. He had defeated Tecumseh in the Battle of Tippecanoe. Harrison's victory in that famous conflict earned him widespread popularity and the nickname Old Tippecanoe. Harrison had another trump card over Johnson. He was a general. Johnson, just a lowly colonel. Perhaps most importantly, though, Harrison was no friend to the Freemasons, which gave him broad appeal in Pennsylvania. As Clay wrote in 1835, "If Pennsylvania will give satisfactory demonstrations of an intention to support Harrison, it will be expedient under all circumstances to run him as the most available candidate against Mr. Van Buren." In October of 1835, Daniel Webster was stunned when the powerful Philadelphia newspaper, the United States Gazette, declared its support for Harrison. The Gazette liked Webster, but they felt he was unelectable, his influence confined to the New England region. Harrison, though, was a popular war hero and had potential for national appeal, even in the South. It seemed Harrison's star was rising, but Whig leaders understood that the Anti-Masons were the deciding factor. So before Pennsylvania Whigs made their statewide nomination, their leadership looked to the Anti-Mason Convention to point them in the direction of the right candidate. In December of 1835, at the Anti-Mason Convention in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Anti-Masons ditched Webster and officially nominated William Henry Harrison. That same month, Pennsylvania Whigs met in convention and did the same. As one Whig member ruefully observed, "The decision to support Harrison was decided by our masters, the Anti-Masons." In the 1836 election, the pattern established in Pennsylvania was repeated in various states, but with varying results. For example, in Massachusetts, the anti-Masons and the Whigs there also joined forces, but nominated Daniel Webster. Nationally, Whigs and anti-Masons came together to defeat the man they called the insidious Masonic Van Buren, but they could not decide on a single national candidate. For some, this was a result of the Whigs' infancy or their lack of organization as a political party. For others, it was a sign of a clever political strategy. Van Buren knew that even with the help of the anti-Masons, without a single national candidate, the Whigs could not beat him outright. But he also knew his prospects for the presidency might be hampered by the 12th Amendment. The 12th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution dictates that in the event no presidential candidate receives a majority of electoral votes, the House of Representatives would decide the election. Van Buren knew that the presence of multiple regional candidates could split the vote and throw the contest to the House, where anti-Jackson, anti-Mason, and anti-Van Buren sentiment was strong. In the House of Representatives, as Van Buren was fully aware, the Whigs had a fighting chance of blocking his path to the White House and hand-picking the next president. Tired of ads and promos like these? Want to skip ahead to newer elections? You can listen to all episodes of American Elections Wiki Game without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com. But not only that, you also get access to over a dozen more incredible history podcasts, also all ad-free. That includes the American Revolution podcast, a deep and thorough investigation of the times, people, and politics behind America's fight for independence. Also, the battles, because we can't start a new American nation without guns. And the American Revolution podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end, from its origins in the French and Indian War, through the war itself, and on to the founding of the United States. Get American Elections Wicked Game, the American Revolutions podcast, and many others, ad-free, with bonus content, at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com. Did you know you can skip ads and promos like these and listen to all episodes of American Elections Wicked Game without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com? And not only will you be getting the whole series ad-free and bingeable, but you also get access to over a dozen more incredible history podcasts, also ad-free, like Her Half of History. Because even though Hillary Clinton may not have made history when she ran for president in 2016, there have always been women who seized power, spied for their country, created artistic masterpieces, even escaped slavery. Her Half of History is perfect for all those who sat in history class and wondered, what were the women doing all this time? Because the answer is a lot. Get Her Half of History, Wicked Game, and many others ad-free at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com. It might be said that the so-called Whig strategy in 1836 was not a strategy at all, but rather a result of a disorganized anti-Jackson movement that lacked national definition. Whigs fell on both sides of controversial political questions like the Second Bank, tariffs, and internal improvements. The only true unifying Whig principle was opposition to King Andrew I. But whether or not there was a method behind the Whig strategy to put forward multiple regional candidates, White, Webster, and Harrison, were taken seriously by the pro-Jackson, pro-Van Buren Democrats. In July of 1836, the Democratic National Convention released a statement decrying the Whig strategy to throw the election to the House. The statement urged Democrats not to secede from the ranks of their party and throw themselves into the arms of their political enemies. Of the three Whig candidates, White, a true Southern candidate, was the most problematic. In the statement, Democrats attacked White's candidacy, saying its only purpose was to divide the party and play into the Whig strategy. White was problematic for another reason, too. Unlike Van Buren, his pro-slavery views were not in question. So in mid-1836, Martin Van Buren again made his case to the South. He wrote multiple letters to prominent Southern Democrats, reassuring them that he was a friend to Virginia principles. But while Van Buren lobbied for the South's support, he faced a barrage of attacks in the press there, primarily from the Telegraph. Van Buren responded by publishing a letter where he laid out his political views. But in the long diatribe, which took up multiple columns, there was one subject that was conspicuously absent: slavery. For Van Buren, privately defending slavery to the South was one thing, but publicly advocating for the practice was another, and Van Buren's silence cost him. In August of 1836,
The Telegraph raked Van Buren over the coals, calling him a coward, too afraid to take a real position on slavery. They wrote that Van Buren, like a cunning man, if not a wise one, he chose silence as the best exposition of his opinions. The article also painted Van Buren as a puppet for Jackson's agenda. Mr. Van Buren might have comprised the substance of his letter in a much smaller compass. We can put the whole motto in a sentence. I say ditto to General Jackson. The Telegraph also cast Van Buren as an elite, no better than a British lord. And the attacks kept coming all the way through the election, which was held from November 3rd to December 7th, 1836. And while the country waited to learn the results, the debate over slavery raged on. In the 1830s, Congress was flooded with anti-slavery petitions from citizens. They received 130,000 in 1836 and 1837 alone. In response, the Democratic-controlled House had passed the first of many gag rules, resolutions that postponed action on anti-slavery petitions and silenced debate on the issue. But in the winter of 1837, 2 days before the electoral votes were counted, one Whig congressman pressed the issue. John Quincy Adams, the only president to return to the House of Representatives after serving in the White House. In early February 1837, Adams bent the rules and broke the silence. It's February 6th, 1837, in the House chamber in Washington. Massachusetts Congressman John Quincy Adams has the floor. He has a stack of dozens of anti-slavery petitions from New Hampshire, New York, Michigan, and Virginia. But there's one piece of paper in particular that he plans to use as a weapon.
Gentlemen, I have in my possession a paper from 20 persons declaring themselves to be slaves, upon which I wish to have the decision of the Speaker. I wish to know whether the Speaker will consider this paper as coming under the rule of the House.
Adams is pressing the issue of the gag rule, deliberately baiting his Southern counterparts into a fight. The Speaker replies,
"The gentleman has the paper in his hands. He is the best judge of the matter. If the gentleman will send the paper to the chair will make a determination."
"As you wish, Mr. Speaker." Alabama Congressman Joab Lawler leaps to his feet.
"Objection, Mr. Speaker. This document must not go to the table under the rules of the House."
Lawler is joined by a throng of Southern congressmen who condemn Mr. Adams. Virginia Congressman William Berkeley Lewis presses for punitive action.
"Mr. Speaker, the House should immediately punish the member. I second the motion."
Adams rises one last time to his defense.
"Mr. Speaker, it is my duty to remain silent while these resolutions, charging me with high crimes, are pending. But as the gentlemen of this House have gone on consuming the time of the House in such a manner, I also feel a duty to show these resolutions for what they are, erroneous. I simply rose in my place and stated that I had in my possession a letter from 20 persons representing themselves to be slaves. I did not state what the object of the paper was."
Adams knows the paper's object. It calls for the eradication of slavery. But in a clever move, he plays dumb.
"The gentleman from Alabama might find that the object of the petition is precisely what he has been so strenuously contending for. So, Mr. Speaker, all petitions should be received, whether they come from the wealthiest individuals in the land or the poorest among us. I hope, Mr. Speaker, that no distinction will be made in petitions in a free government, lest we make ourselves fit instruments for the abuse of a despot."
In the late 1830s, John Quincy Adams repeatedly challenged the gag rule. In one speech, he stated, "You begin with suppressing the right of petition. You must next suppress the right of speech in the House. What will be the consequence then? You suppress the right of petition, you suppress the freedom of speech, the freedom of the press, and the freedom of religion? For in the minds of many, this is a religious question in which they act under what they believe to be a sense of duty to their God." On the same day that Adams made his stand, John C. Calhoun offered a counterargument on the floor of the Senate. "Unless anti-slavery petitions be speedily stopped, it will spread, till it brings the two great sections of the Union into deadly conflict." Calhoun's argument was a portend of what was to come. On February 8, 1837, Congress counted the electoral votes. Van Buren won by a slim margin, 50.8% of the popular vote. He won 15 states, mainly in the North.
He took Pennsylvania, but narrowly. Van Buren beat Harrison by less than 5,000 of the nearly 180,000 votes cast. In the past two elections, President Jackson had made a strong showing in the South. Van Buren didn't fare nearly as well. There, Van Buren ran nearly even with Hugh Lawson White, even losing Jackson's home state of Tennessee, a sobering fact that showed that the Democratic Party was no longer fully the party of Andrew Jackson. It was thought that the Whigs had hoped to throw the 1836 contest to the House, where they unite around a single candidate and beat Van Buren. Their strategy failed, but Congress still had a part to play in the election of 1836. Democrats in Virginia refused to vote for Van Buren's running mate, in large part because of Johnson's scandalous relationship to Julia Chin. As a result, he fell one vote short of an electoral majority. So for the first and only time in American history, the Senate exercised the power of the 12th Amendment and selected the vice president. On February 8th, the Senate convened and cast their votes. But despite the many strikes against him, the largely pro-Jackson Senate named Richard Johnson vice president. Throughout Van Buren's first term, Johnson's personal life would continue to make headlines. According to the rumors, after Julia died of cholera, Johnson took two of Julia's nieces as common-law wives before selling them off. Ultimately, Van Buren would have no choice but to cut ties with his vice president. And while the Whigs lost the 1836 contest, they made an impressive showing, especially in the South. That's in large part due to the issue of slavery. In the 1830s, anti-slavery sentiment was growing, and in response, the South built fortifications around the plantation economy. To them, neither Van Buren nor Johnson were true champions of the Virginia principles. In the 1836 contest, the pro-Jackson dominance seen in the elections of 1828 and 1832 had all but faded away. In its place, what would come to be called the second two-party system had taken root, the era of the Whigs and the Democrats. In 1836, Van Buren had won by the skin of his teeth. In the 1840 contest, Van Buren would have another difficult fight on his hands, made all the worse by a devastating crisis that would cripple the American economy. Van Buren's response to what would come to be called the Panic of 1837 would cost him in the election of 1840, and he would leave the door open for a Whig candidate who had made a strong showing in 1836, General William Henry Harrison. This is episode 13 of American Elections Wicked Game, 1836, Sin on the Ballot. On the next episode, the election of 1840, the Whigs seek to deny Van Buren a second term. But to beat the little magician, the Whigs take a page out of the Democrats' playbook and unite behind their own man of the people, General William Henry Harrison. Did you know you can skip ads and promos like these and listen to all episodes of American Elections Wicked Game without interruption by subscribing at IntoHistory.com? And not only will you be getting the whole series ad-free and bingeable, but you also get access to over a dozen more incredible history podcasts, also all ad-free, like Wild West Extravaganza, a journey back to the fascinating, tumultuous, and often violent world of the American Old West. From famous outlaws like Billy the Kid and Jesse James, to lawmen like Wyatt Earp and Wild Bill Hickok, to trailblazing pioneers and frontiersmen, Wild West Extravaganza tells the true stories of the real-life characters who shaped this iconic era. So saddle up and discover the true history of the American frontier, the good, the bad, and the ugly, ad-free at IntoHistory.com. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details. And while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. American Elections Wicked Game is an Airship production. Hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. Co-executive produced by Stephen Walters in association with Ritual Productions. Written and researched by Stephen Walters. Fact-checking by Greg Jackson and C.L. Salazar from the podcast History That Doesn't Suck.